I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
This is Adam of Ethereal and E. Tune in on March 28th at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic on KBOO Portland.
Welcome to the Talking Earth here on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon, and welcome to spring. I'm your poetry DJ, or PJ, Dan Raphael. We have extended sets tonight from Amy Baskin, Lex Runciman, and Kirsten Berger, and I'll be filling in between with poems by Samia Bashir, Donald Dunbar, and probably myself. So let's kick right in with Amy. Amy Baskin's work is currently featured in Carl Coggins' Wednesday Night Poetry, Pyrene's Fountain, Friend's Journal, and is forthcoming in Pilgrimage. She is a Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net nominee, an Oregon Literary Arts Fellow, and an Oregon Poetry Association Prize winner. When not writing, she helps run literary arts programs, including Fur Acres Writing Workshop at Lewis and Clark College. She is the author of one chapbook, Hysterical Cake, published by Dancing Girl Press last year, and her collection, Night Hag, from Unsolicited Press, will be born in April 2023. And now, here's Amy.
Hello, my name is Amy Baskin, and I'd like to thank Dan Raphael for inviting me to share my work here with you. I have some poems that are on the theme of connection and disconnection, many of which were published in visual verse online, and also many of them are in my current chapbook, Hysterical Cake, which was recently published by Dancing Girl Press. So I'll start us off with one that's on a wintry theme called Bear and Brave. Bear and Brave, supine, waiting for warmth, for the effete blues to turn to action, but for now recumbent, a fungal outcropping at the root of a barren trunk. Do humors circulate through me? What gives me the strength to move through this rectangular world, angling for signs of greenery, the flush of a sexed winterberry clustered on a twig, asymmetry to muscle me forth and back again? The second poem is entitled Skin Hunger. Wet, get me wet. Let me feel the droplets, a sacrament that soothes my head. Head, trim my head, cut the hedge that grows on top. Scissor sick thoughts at the bud. Bud, I can bloom alone here in my self-care state. I can sprout in places I never imagined before, before the alone time, before the skin hunger, sweat and vapor anointed by touch and breath. Breath of a lover, a stranger, caressing the nape of my neck in a grocery line. Line up when this blows over. Place your hands on my cheeks, my arm, my waist. Waste no time. I will be here, maintaining myself, painting my nails, wearing the sunlight in welcome. This next poem is called Canning. Did I remember to thoroughly wash my hands before donning these gloves? Just to be sure, should I wash them again, this time with awareness? Snap out of this daze where I imagine my father resurfaces, creeping from ether. If I squint, he appears, as does every microbe that sent him away. Tonight, the sun sets earlier than last night in this solitude. I have barely borne it with the aid of summer sun. When I preserve the last cherries, I will fold into myself a bruised blue batter, praying for a keeping ring and a lid to contain me. This next poem is called Interbeing. Interbeing. The main thing is to enjoy the moment. Observe the space between breaths, the cinching of the suit, clasping wrist and thigh, a pressure cuff, watching the needle tick lower on the oxygen meter. Collaboration convening with emptiness. The space between the idea of birth and the surety of death with collapse of lungs. The knowledge that this feeling of disconnect is nothing but a thought. It too shall pass, as surely as my frame, this scaffold of carbon and water, this lens through which the universe experiences itself unfolding, is a part of the atmosphere, the liquid blue drop of ocean it orbits, the loam still underneath my fingernails, another abandoned satellite that has outlived its function. A few more deep breaths would be nice, if only to observe that the main thing is to enjoy the moment. This next poem is entitled Temporary, and it contains the title of this my new collection. Temporary. When I felt as though a piece of myself was missing after giving birth, that's because a piece of myself was missing after giving birth. If the transitory nature of my pregnancy took me from what once seemed a stable frame of mind to what next felt as manic as an organ solo on acid after giving birth, perhaps that's because I felt a piece of myself, a flat slab of hysterical cake, form, set, bake, and then flop out of its springform pan, a birthday ache that gifted my child life. Afterbirth. The next poem is entitled She-Wolf. If you were ever incarcerated and sentenced to death by starvation, I would be your paro and endow you with sustenance. Jailed plebeian, I would nourish you. Feel my milk let down as I write this. Pins and needles of ecstatic pain gushing to joy and relief. If you were stranded, sick, and starving in the corner of a barn, I would find you, hold my teat to your lips, and feed you like my own children. This is the kiss of life, no mere write-off. My largesse is a handout I most willingly contribute. Even Juno suckled Hercules. I fattened Romulus and Remus, hid them in the Lupercal den. I have even fostered orphan bear cubs when their own blood has failed them, though no one writes of this. I express to you oblation. For what is life, if not radical kinship, if not competent at giving, at sharing each lick and drop of cream? The next poem is entitled At the Waterfall. Weave through the parking lot. Follow the signs, buy postcards of the tallest, most magnificent waterfall in the park. Ask strangers to take pictures. Scurry down the path towards the gift shop. Smash a souvenir penny for only 50 cents. Eat a soft serve and hop back in the car. Check it off the list of to-dos. One kid stops the smooth flow of people. Tourists bump into each other in line. The kid ripples through them, darts under a guardrail, breaks away while his dad wipes mist off the camera lens. This kid squats and stares at a trickle, a small spurt of water, a meager rivulet, barely perceptible. Not the main stage, not even a sideshow, no billing accorded it. This kid chucks a rock in that trickle, hops in up to both ankles, splashing and grinning, joins the stream of thin water, limbs swishing, cheeks flushed, as if it too is worth knowing. The next poem is entitled Brothers, Oregon, 97712, population 87. odd in its insistence of the plural. Neglected siblings of sisters. Sisters thrives, nursed by glaciers. Life springs forth from those mountains. Brothers feeds on errant travelers, swollen four times its size by our presence alone, a succulent during a flood. At the general store, the woman sells us a solitary arrowhead and half of a glistening thunder egg. We flip through milk cartons full of vintage Life magazines, trapped insects in amber, pristine in their laminate sleeves. In the corner, a TV offers its cataract lens of a fearsome world with no turning back. In the great expanse of sagebrush and sky, will the lone raptor fall prey to those warnings? To the west, the Cascades are dwarfed by distance and the high altitude of abandonment. On a dusty stoop by the gas pumps, next to an ancient creek bed, we sip glass-bottled Cokes, speculating what lies further east. We could have taken the road crossing the Ochocos past the caged grizzly bear at the Mitchell gas station, into Picture Canyon and beyond John Day. Looking at the blank swath on the map, it would be wrong to avoid this stretch any longer, to forever wonder and fear the dry, vacant roads, the towns in name only. We must pay respect to the severed relations. The next poem is also one of Oregon, and it has to do with a tragedy that occurred in my neighborhood. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. And I named it after one of the heroes of the event, who was looking to take care of two young women on the MAX train. Talesian. Tell everyone on this train that I love them. Talesian Namkai Mesh, Hollywood Transit Center, Green Line, Portland, Oregon, May 26th, 2017. In the seat next to you sits a stranger, shining brow, sweating. Shirt stains evident, exhaustion palpable like your own. For one moment, close your eyes in trust. Can you feel him? Not his hands or the side of his body, his heart source. Can you open? Is your skin thin enough for his love to permeate you? Could he be your murderer? He may have daggers within him. I have seen those who have thrown away their souls for nothing. Could he be your prophet? He may be capable. I have seen those who have given up their lives, and they are everything. The next poem is entitled Leavings. Leavings. There was a man, no, many men, who touched me, mouthed me, ate me. I swabbed their cheeks with my tongue. I see them in my son and daughter, though they are not their fathers. And women, too, many times over. Anyone who ever changed me has entered me. I have a gate with no lock, permeable as the skin of a cell block, molecular as connective tissue, and equally empty. Stay a while, then pass through me, and the residue you leave behind, I will smoke it, inhale you until you too leave no trace. This last poem, second to last poem, is called The Tandava, which is named after the dance which Shiva performs at the end of an age. Our world is ending now. Those who expect one massive explosion that lifts them saved out of their shoes and into the arms of a hot, muscled savior do not see it. I never thought the end would be so constant, so continuous, so utterly devoid of finality. There is no door to close on the courtroom while we rest down the hall. The jury deliberates, but air, soil, and water, the acting tribunal, have exhaled the verdict for now, and all parties are bound. I step outside in the rain, watch the wheels of Shiva roll down the city street during prime chaos hours, see an addict dance between traffic, recognize him as my own son, blue-faced and covered in ash, wave him down, cup his cold, wet cheeks in my hands, and smiling at me, he whispers, "In the cycle, growth happens next." Thank you all for listening. For my final poem, I'd like to read one last poem from my collection, Hysterical Cake. Again, it's with Dancing Girl Press, and it's a chapbook, not a collection. And this poem is entitled Pluvial. Pluvial. Like raindrops, practice falling. Say, once a week, just as something we do, like flossing or scheduling sex. It becomes our nature, like laughing or clapping. Land and bond, covalent in our failures. Huddle routinely in cold potholes. Wait for our mistakes to evaporate. Fall again without knowing where to land or with whom. Raindrops know they will splash and form puddles or hit pavement. We should learn as well. Expect each sudden misstep, each pool of blood. Skinned knees, scraped palms, bear witness to sacrament. How ordinary, how manifest to rise up again. Thank you.
Thanks, Amy. Next up are two poems from Samia Bashir's Oregon Book Award-winning collection, Field Theories. Sore, broken in the place of dragons. How we pockmark our sickening ball of melt. How we crawl among animals having forgotten their names. How we swoon red-faced and cry to our small, silly star. How we fall in love a little each crisp, stupid winter. How we bow clavicles against nights long and snow quiet. How we can't recall midsummer even in its midst. How we seize awe at the jerk of our cretinous work. How we breathe out our parasitic breath, then breathe it in. How we watch again as light breaches our wobbly horizon. How we know the time has arrived to rise. You don't have to pump the brakes, and that's B-R-E-A-K-S. You don't have to pump the brakes, you just gotta keep your eyes on the road. You know how the universe blinks, and we exist for a minute or two with our classic hit stations and our marshmallows, our wars and flags and television and shit? Coke bottles falling from the sky to an old man's village, and the white people just laugh and laugh and line up to pay and laugh and get paid and laugh. That's what they made. He'll clean it up. This is the world spinning its circle in the vast dark, and this is us arguing the same shit on a new machine, faster. The world stays unstable anyway. We work all day to excess, and for what? What will we make of it? Try to recall the red crest of a robin's breast in springtime. Springtime. When we fight our machines with our machines through our machines, it's the thought that hurts. When we stand one hand airborne, one finger on play. When we pump the volume up against the goddamn bird song. Anyway, she even got a breast reduction, my friend said. That's how stupid she is, my friend said. An Anthropocene of wannabe hepcats wanting to be. But this is the world, spinning in the vast dark. Not any of the million spots we see in the night sky, but the one we can't. Rushing to the serenity shop and fighting and hiding and crying and eating in our cars with our volume pumped against the bird song. We are animals. We need orgasm regularly. Now, even that lies just out of reach, hostage to the ding of our nearby cells. A poke, a text, a like, a love, a comment. Well done. Yearn for the road. Ache for the unfettered journey. Grow weary of it. Namaste, the mat says. Killed people kill people, it says. Shock, disbelief, wildly darting eyes, same old jive. Look steady through the pain. Go on, trust me, really take in the light. Samia Bashir from Field Theories. And now for Lex Runciman. He is a Portland native, author of 6 books of poems, including The Admirations, which won the Oregon Book Award in Poetry, and Salt Moon's Poems 1981 through 2021, published by Salmon Poetry in Ireland. After a long teaching career, 11 years at Oregon State and 25 years at Linfield, he and his wife of 50 years have returned to Portland. And now let's hear some of Lex's poems. Take it away.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to start with several poems from Salt Moons, published in 2017 by Salmon Poetry. This first poem tells a story, in this case, a story about a fellow named George Reeder, a real person, 63 years old, and doing his job as dockmaster at Watchet Harbor, which is a small place on the Atlantic coast in Somerset, England. The poem tries to imagine what George Reeder actually did and how he might have felt about it in the end. In praise of George Reeder. Wind blows a baby stroller right off the wharf and 3 feet down to water. A woman shouts as the stroller sinks, rolls and sinks. You do not empty your pockets or remove your shoes, only your coat. You jump in. Do not notice the water's temperature, only that you cannot move as surely or quickly as you wish. If there is noise, you do not hear. The stroller floats with a current, does not entirely disappear. At last, you grab a handle, kick and scull, pulling it, stroller and child, to where someone else has let down a rope, which you wrap and knot with fingers that have thickened. The stroller passes you as they haul it up, and the child buckled in looks slumped, asleep, soaked. You shiver now. You have climbed out and put on your coat as a woman you have never seen kneels, hair in her face as she works and works, pressing that small chest until she stops, leans back a little, the child moving an arm, the child crying, water running down your face, the mother who has had to watch this, sobbing, covering her mouth. And even now a helicopter angles in against the wind, with the wind, the mother and child taken inside and lifted away. This is the purest thing you can remember doing, and anyone would have, this bright gift, a privilege you'd wish on no one. Okay, to become a parent is to experience 2 births, really. One is the birth, the arrival of your child, and the second is your own birth as an entirely new person, experiencing a fear and a love that you can't have previously known. To be responsible for an infant can feel like an impossible obligation. This poem is titled Whatever Day This Is. On and off shadows under the residential trees, so that as I drive, I squint on and off, as you hold the baby snoring lightly on your shoulder. Resting like that, our daughter looks blissful, relaxed. She's not. She's exhausted. Whatever day this is, we've not slept since Tuesday. We've talked to doctors. We're following directions to a hospital. The road seems weirdly mobile, and you're sitting like sculpture, upright, controlled. Like money or justice, illness is random. So doctors describe to us the entire surgical procedure for a spinal tap on an infant. Even the surgeon herself looks tired or bored as she angles the pencil just where on the wall chart a length of needle must ease in and sidle by the dime-sized saucers of vertebrae, which must not move. The room slows, and whatever day this is, we nod. They know we're tired, but they want us to hear the symptoms of cerebrospinal meningitis and its complications, which are terrifying and religious. Whatever day this is, we're counting intersections, seeing beautiful trees, dogwoods, whites and pinks, and droopy Himalayan cedars, mown lawns, all this human landscape. At a light, we stop. I squint. You look straight ahead. I love you now and always, whatever day this is, now and always. I don't remember road or traffic. I remember like a snapshot, the rosy fold and gentle curve of a small girl's ear. The meningitis was a lesser thing. We slept and slept. So, at one point, as a writer of poems, I realized that I'd start to recognize the titles of possibly new poems as they appeared in the reading I was doing. I'd read along, a phrase would occur, one that somehow I knew I wanted to respond to. So I'd put that phrase at the top of a page and then wait to see what might come next. Eventually, I had a bunch of these, enough to anchor a book called Starting From Anywhere. I want to read you three of them. The first is titled, My Father is Telling Me the Story. That phrasing comes from a W.S. Merwin poem. It jumped out at me because I'm adopted, and so I have never known my birth father. My father is telling me the story. You have never known the pitch or timbre of your father's voice, nor the touch or shape of his hands, nor the way his brow furrowed. You have not known what he turned away from, closing the door. You have not known what he made of night sky, or the way sun at dawn in November glistens. You have not known his shoes, or watches, or ties, his gait, or religion, or lack of it, nor his sisters, nor his brothers, and of your mother you lack all the same. You look in the mirror, and do not think of this now. You hear through the window a bird you recognize but cannot name. You look in the mirror, but not for who is there. This one is titled, In the Blessed Absence of Television. That phrase comes from a prose work by John Burnside. I can remember when our first television arrived. My parents weren't sure where to put it. And I can remember the vacant lot near our house. This poem is actually in three parts. It begins in the past, comes to the present, and ends with a comment that includes the fact that I have two daughters. In the blessed absence of television. If you knew where in the vacant lot, past the prunings, leaves, bushes hauled there to root or rot, where weeds in their exuberance rose, if you dug there, you found pink worms, noodly segmented live things expanding and contracting, eager for the dark. That place holds a house now, I don't know whose. The creek goes in a concrete pipe, but I remember it off otherwise. If last spring we had children in this house, they would have seen the tenacity of robins on a nest, an illustration of whatever they would make of it. Three eggs, three robins fledged, all that slow construction and raucous hunger. Then a second try and none to hatch. They would have asked us to fix the injustice or explain the rules. About the people who at birth gave me up, I construct idle, insufficient stories. I believe both of them are dead. What is there to blame them for? They greet me, the best of them, in my daughters. As for secrets, some we keep, and some keep us. The last one of these with a quoted title comes from the Walt Whitman poem, I Sing the Body Electric. The phrase that became the poem's title is, all is a procession. For who knows what reasons, the poem turned out to be about, well, the talking earth. It turned out to be about oak trees, though near the end it also turns briefly to the human body. All is a procession. The oaks out my window, the roads and byways of their great bark exposed, or by mosses thickened, moss green all the seasons but August, the green then almost rust. The oaks out my window, columns wide at the ground and thinning higher, splitting, branching and splitting, rivers draining air into the sea of the ground, and the ground's water rising to ever smaller streams and dissipations. Each leaf, all that rustles quiet in the currents of day, noisy in the currents of the dark. My arms cannot circle the oaks out my window. Their age is not of grandfathers or mothers, but grand dozen mothers and fathers, who idled under those winter bare scaffolds and marked their own breath as they looked up at snow, who dozed in June's warm and insect whine, stared at shadow, and thought of what next to do, and stood then and walked away. The oaks out my window balk account. Mistletoe thick in their crowns balks account, and lichens sleeving their slender arms, flags of ferns aloft in their branched hollows, birds fond of acorns and squirrels fond of acorns, worms inside puffballs like decorations hung, all balk account. Iris and lens aqueous humors, heart and bronchial trees, and tympanum hammer stirrup and anvil, the meanders of finger pads each itself, and jays territorial, quail and song swallows, the voice that calls and the voice that answers, by accidents, by causes and endless effects, all evolution has led alike to the oaks out my window. I see them every day, and they balk account, as does my happiness seeing them. Let me close with two poems from Unlooked For, a new book that, circumstances being what they are, may or may not be published this year. The first is titled A Margin of Trust. The poem tries to define what that phrase might mean. A margin of trust. Between voice and story, that place a child might seek beside a parent reading. Against illness, hope's memory of health. Goodwill that cancels offense or disregard, as between me and you, the presumptions and actions of decency, a willingness to question and listen, a margin of trust. And some rare days entire, dark to dark, its call and response, plan and action, no hitch in the breath, only ease, a cloudless October wind-aided day. Horizons bend gentle, waves shallow, the tide out far. Each step in that sand wide dry, a shift and slide that squelches, gives, then bottoms, rock below, all emptiness of blue above. And in it, held and restless in its own margin, a kite painted with two huge eyes, the tether string soon invisible. So, a hovering of restless unblinking, above a swaying length of thin, knotted fabric tail. Of vigilance, aloft, and curious to gulls, as we take turns holding on. And last, with thanks again to you, Dan, and to KBOOO, Song of Bowl and Cup. Cup of anger, cup of sleep, bowl of honey, bowl of grief, cup of water, bowl of blossoms, cup of whiskey, bowl of sky, cup to be shunned, bowl to be shared, bowl to be set down, cup of justice, cup of want, bowl to be set down, cup of ochre, cup of glass, bowl of the nest of blue eggs, song of bowl, cup of song, absent one, the other will do.
Thanks, Lex. And now here are a couple poems from Donald Dunbar. There's a book called Safe Word that came out in 2017, but hey, poetry is eternal. Poem against James Gendron, for James Gendron. A poem against James Jack Gendron is as much a poem against Octopus Books, which published Jack's first book, and is therefore war basically on small press poets, all other poets, the concept of magazines, etc., as it is a poem for Jack's mom. And like Jack's mom, I want to be your mom, Jack. Beyond that, I want to birth all poets, all poetry presses, such as Octopus Books, etc. Anyone who's ever looked at a poem, basically you, y'all. I want to be your mom and steal your food from you, chew it up for you, spit it on the table in front of you, and smirk. I want to clean up after you move out, having had enough of my shit, to live in a public park or something. I'll figure it out, trickling up your brainstem. To survive on what? Squirrels? Octopus Books? Lotto tickets and kindness? Like how you need that book because you gave birth to it. And if you didn't have it, you'd have nothing. Nothing. An amniotic sac and nothing. It's like an oral history that can only remember 15 years back as, okay, pretty practical. Like meat. Like a surgeon cooks a steak. Like a chicken cooks an egg. Like on the count of three, everyone shout the name of someone you miss. Money poem. Money is an extrovert. Money is social, sociopathic. Money is important in many games, but less so in children's games, and can be used in sex games, as when I paid my girlfriend for sex and she said, acting, money gets me wet. Money gets wet. If money floats, it floats only for a minute. Money has been made into shelter, into clothing, cooked into food. It tastes like butter, fuzz, or blood. Money for beer? Money is power. Money is quiet. Money electronic. Money is ancient. Money is illegal to destroy, can be saved, often has a person's face on it. Money ripped apart and put back together is still money and can, in some circumstances, be used to own a person. Money, in most circumstances, can be used to own an animal. Money can be folded into an origami pig. Money has a lifespan. It can be nostalgic. Money fascinates most 50-year-olds and is given away by 90-year-olds. Money is the way some small children say mommy. Rhymes with dozens of words, including runny, can be misheard as many, many, manny, and muddy, owns the word by. Money is an anagram of one my. Money makes me excited, bored, and anxious, makes me think of food, makes the world go round, had to be invented. Money can be invented, vested, can fill a bank, cannot fill a bank account, is usually counted in base 10. Money is non-monogamous. Money is sometimes fun money. Money is blood money, hush money, dirty money, seed money. Money is not exactly wealth. Money is a tool, my parents tell me. Money is something my parents still ask me about, and one way people talk about the impact of 9/11. Money is on everyone around you right now, is useful in most social activities, is one reason for suicide. Money shot compilation. Money hidden in a flute. Money versus people. Who would win? Versus animals? Who would win? Versus insects? Who would win? Money is all over the room, and you have 1 minute to grab as much as you can. Donald Dunbar from Safe Word. And so now we go to our third and final featured poet, Kristen Berger. Kristen is the author of 5 published poetry collections, including Changing Woman, Changing Man, A High Desert Myth, just out from Nightjar Press, which she's reading from tonight. Also Refugia from Persian Poetry Press and Echolocation from Cirque Press. Earthwork will come out this August from the Poetry Box. Productive person. A recipient of residencies from Playa and OSU's Spring Creek Project. She works as the program director and administrator of Green Lens, a climate justice nonprofit in Lentz, Portland. Find more of her poetry, including how to order books, at Kristen Berger Poet. That's B-E-R-G-E-R and K-R-I-S-T-I-N. KristenBergerPoet.com. So now for some of Kristen's poetry.
Hi, this is Kristen Berger, and I'll be reading from my new book, Changing Woman, Changing Man, A High Desert Myth. It is a book that is in a long poem form with alternate voices, so there aren't individual poems, but I will read from the middle section. It's split into 3 sections, morning, afternoon, and night. And I'm going to read from the afternoon section. And the book also has lino cut prints made by Diane Sandel, and together we worked on this book and are pretty darn happy with it. So if you want to read the morning and the night sections, then you'll have to get the book. Afternoon. The house is unoccupied, but at peace. Dust devils lap at juniper slats and sift through tin shingles. Windows and doors have been left open. Anyone can find shelter while they are away. Swallows daub nests. Grit chinks the cracks. Any near-dying creature can borrow shade, water. Their agreement with each other to build a temple for light and dark to move through, free of leashes and traps, full of motes slow tagging the day. Outside, trails veer toward ridges and snowpacks, following abandoned wagon passes, blazing apart, converging like streams, leaving no trace at high noon. Changing Man. Changing Man is a long walk. He discovers planets, befriends them. He adds them up on the back of gas receipts. Changing Man is an open book. He tried climbing cliffs. His lovers leaped. He cries obsidian tears once a year. Changing Man sweeps up the crumbs. He sets traps. He bundles emergency flares in the trunk. He changes his own tires. Changing Man once trick-or-treated as a girl. His little dog completes him. He makes friends at crossroads, but forgets names. He tells jokes to married women in grocery aisles. He doesn't think everything is funny. Changing Man bets on poker with pennies and peanuts. He chances everything. He controls his burn. Changing Man is a solar flare. He comes for her like a sidewinder. He flushes quail from the sage. He sends messages in the form of slow-burning space trash. His grip is as tender as a glove's. His hands rest on his lap like latticework. Changing Man is a job well done. He works with the blinds drawn. He eavesdrops on the wainscoting. He is a groom in the apps. Changing Man is a spotlight. He searches and rescues. His brush fire licks east and west. He tastes the Alps when daydreaming. He whittles driftwood into clothespins. Changing Man yells at TV referees. His silence clears the couch. He falls behind on the rent. He is an empty swimming pool in July. He protects his eyes. He is a six-pack of self-selected singles. Changing Man is not the Marlboro Man. He falls asleep watching Kung Fu. His spark plugs are changed according to dealer recommendations. He nurses his daughter's earlobes when infected. He is the doctor. Changing Man resuscitates pet turtles. He is a mystery to himself. His pillow knows him best. He is a rainbow between storms. He leaves ozone in her hair. He nods off mid-conversation. Changing Man is a Super 8 projector playing in the basement. He lives reel to reel. His memories unfurl like a county road. He trades in his pickup for Camaro. He is haggle and deal and take away. Changing Man gives everything to the women and children's shelter. He is about to die. He steers a wooden-hulled cutter. His letter jacket still fits. He lets women lean into his shoulders. He fixes her milkshakes. He traces her spine. Changing Man planes his schedule smooth. His days spiral around his feet. He curls with grief. He is a blaze tree. Changing Man is the camp counselor with the most crushes. He is a wood-burning kit. His whole life waits. His roots take hold like willow. He stands at the altar. He is a jilted bride. He shakes hands with the minister. Changing Man takes a long, hard look at the facts. He's a pretty good shot. He ties flies to kill time. His office chair is empty. He takes to water like a water witch. Changing Man wishes to be less thirsty. His jeans go unpatched. He burns his love letters in the cook stove. Changing Man is a message in a bottle chucked to the rabbit brush. He is remotely beautiful. He has many angles. He leaves tracks. He pirates the neighbor's Wi-Fi. He covets wives. Changing Man is a controlled burn. He is a winter inversion. His day is windless. He never blinks out. His cables tunnel under mountains. He is a fuse. Changing Man is a sun dog. His howl is heard for hundreds of miles. His love trespasses. He apologizes. He finds what he has been searching for. His den litters the range. He is a flyway. He paves the roads. He lights the homes. Changing Man is never alone. Changing Woman. Changing Woman is a mackerel sky. She swings in the trysting tree. Her skirt breezes up. She forgets the language of ice. She finds the quickest pulse on the body and burrows. Changing Woman is a disappearing river. She faults and strikes. She is cottonwood shade. Her well is the one in all the county, not spoiled. Changing Woman invites you in for a drink. She communes in the nude. She buttons up tight when the mailman knocks. She walks to great lengths to deliver a message. She chalks memos on boulders. Changing Woman heats the baking stone. Her bread rises twice. She stretches barbed wire fences, she interrogates the sun. Her skies cloud over, her eyes drain from blue to gray. She wears fingerless gloves. Changing Woman is a tag train headed for Canada. She slow burns for winter. She craves sugar snow. She spikes her iced tea and dials an old boyfriend. She is the wrong number. Changing Woman is a party line. She is shared among her friends. Her hot dish is legendary. She staples notices of missing pets to telephone poles. She leans her ear into the wood. Her breathing is barely audible. She can feel him coming. Changing Woman needs restringing. She reaches for his hands. She is a sun-starched hawk. She hunts all day in the thermals. She spooks her prey. Changing Woman starves. She is the lone juniper for miles. She diverts water with a galvanized flume. Her lake bed wants to be inundated. Her grasses are riddled with shortcuts. She is an exit strategy. She has a recovery plan. Changing Woman drives the cutoff. Changing Woman learns that change is her first and middle and last name. She calls herself by her nickname. She is one of the women who offended God. She smacks her gum in church. She tacks her thesis to the door. She would rather dive into a punch bowl in a bikini than hang out by the keg. Changing Woman is about to die. She naps on the family plots. Her dates are rubbed by strangers. She mouths old names long out of fashion. She'll put anything in her mouth. She writes with lemon ink. She needs his match. Her secrets come to life, then burn. Changing Woman is a Jenny Lind trunk. She is filled with reams. She is bound for an inland sea. Her stormfront arrives late for lunch. Changing Woman is a skipping stone. She ripples all the way to shore. She swan dives from the dock. Her stroke is unorthodox. She kicks crayfish out of the way. Changing Woman balances a Diet Coke on her belly and floats. Her children can't hear her, and she can't hear them. Her dog paces the bank. Her barometer is falling. Changing Woman is 100% chance of lightning. She runs to take in all the towels. She climbs the tallest tree with a transistor radio. She is a storm cellar all buttoned up. She prays down with the potatoes and apples and salted hams. Her formica table is plastered with playing cards and dead mosquitoes. She folds and refolds the map. Her margins are torn. Changing Woman comes with a legend. She is a horizon without peaks. Her pink eraser is worn down to the nub. She is a flatlander with legs. She carries dead weight. Her apple pies are blue ribboned. She guides his hands through the latticework. Changing Woman feeds chapters of fiction to the fire. She props the door open with an old dictionary. Her cranes settle at an undisclosed location. She is sure that evening follows day. Her future snakes like a fire trail. She scatters rye crumbs in the cedar swamp. She takes off her boots and bra. She unfurls. Changing Woman is the pulse after he pulls away. Her scars rearrange themselves. She is a new constellation beyond the blue. She swarms 20 feet up. Her aspen is de-leafed. Changing Woman is done holding her breath. She is glad for the downpour. She shepherds evening in. She is siesta.
Thanks, Kristen. And now to wrap up the evening with a poem by Dan Raphael. Me. Bone weather. You never have to look far for bones, no matter how much we try to hide them. Bones inside the walls, bones between our teeth, whether the memories or the flesh evaporates first. Memories disturb the soil more than they feed it, returning the calcium miserly as if something could still be recovered. The abandoned factories of bones, sperm and egg like defective raindrops, raindrops rebelling against their fate. A house with good bones can be restored, but a body with rickets, with osteoporosis. The muscles are willing, but the framework's confused. Whether wind or gravity, responsibility or whim, what I feel in my bones, as if an eighth or ninth sense. If things get hot enough, if the pressure implodes time, used to be as if never was, swimming just inches below the surface, as if sea level didn't have constant waves, the tides of time, pendulum of light and shadow. Take the dust out of a moon crater and you soon get the bones, pulled from Earth's sea, collision from whatever cultures chose to send their dead into the heavens above. Whalebone corsets, bone flutes, bones big enough to sleep in, as if marrow didn't have squatter's rights, starved into surrender, bones spiraling like DNA, walking on bones without breaking any. We start with nearly 300 bones that fuse to between 206 and 213, sometimes fuzzy borders between vertebrae, an extra rib on one side, a finger missing a joint, tailbone unable to wag. When the bones begin to sing, when the skin's too thin to silence, not a fracture but a disconnect, as my fat goes away, do I need all these bones? Can't tendons learn to trust one another? Anchor bones, antenna bones, bones that know where to turn, occasionally fed up with muscles getting all the credit, as if bones need eyes or ears to get out of the way when something's coming. Bones would rather dig in than jump. Rest your bones by the fire. Hang your flesh by the door. Wind hasn't the strength to come in. Muscles would unfurl and spread from wall to wall, but bones want to be legible through the cloud ceilings. When angelic satellites come to identify us and hollow our bones so we can fly like the unseen threads of data and yesterday's burnt dinner. One bone to grind the others, bend and recover, stretch into a new octave, complicated junctures of articulate particles, almost holicles, flesh so flawless I'm tempted to believe its independence, as if every pore its own ecosystem, imbalanced stillness, dynamic endurance, from hill to valley, from atmospheric rivers to lakes miles below the surface, caves of flame, clouds of dead skin, the 2 to 5% of rain that's not water, the 1 in 10,000 nothing can stop, tectonic plates spinning on whose bones. So that's bones for you. And this is the Talking Earth, Spring. I'm Dan Raphael. Thanks again to our three poets, Amy Baskin, Lex Runciman, and Kristen Berger. Buy their books, buy my books, buy poetry books, buy a lot of books. But thanks to all of you for listening. To poet engineer Patrick Bocard, and to all the folks at KABU and those supporting KABU, which I hope includes you. KABU needs your help. KABU always needs money, and KABU provides community services that no one else is bringing to you. Commercial free, artistically oriented, truth oriented. Go KABU. And thanks again.
This is a legal ID. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and I am Dr. Demento, just barely legal.
This is KBOO Portland, community radio for the Pacific Northwest. Right now, it's the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time.
And good evening and welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Let's see, we're going to present three pieces from a book by local writer J.D. Chandler, who passed away about a year ago. This is called Murder and Mayhem in Portland, Oregon. And J.D. got into a lot of really interesting Portland history. And so we're going to get into the dark side of the Rose City with our first piece, Mayhem on Morrison Street, 1878. The violence of the Old West that is pervasively portrayed in the movies and popular literature is mostly a myth. The truth is that Western cities such as Portland became more violent the farther they got from pioneer days. The two most common forms of murder in the 19th century, as in the 20th and 21st, were killings that arose out of domestic disputes, such as the murder of Mortimer Stump and alcohol-related violence, such as Portland's first recorded murder, the shooting of Cook. The third most common motive for murder is robbery. The excitement and public uproar that accompanied the shooting of Louis Joseph, a 14-year-old boy, during a violent armed robbery in downtown Portland illustrates how rare these kinds of crimes were at the time. The public execution of two of the robbers, in